Part 5. In light of this holding, the question becomes whether the statute stripping jurisdiction to issue the writ avoids the suspension clause mandate because Congress has provided adequate substitute procedures for habeas corpus. The government submits there has been compliance with the suspension clause because the DTA review process in the Court of Appeals provides an adequate substitute. Congress has granted the court jurisdiction to consider, one, whether the status determination of the CSRT was consistent with the standards and procedures specified by the Secretary of Defense, and two, to the extent the Constitution and laws of the United States are applicable, whether such use of such standards and procedures to make the determination is consistent with the Constitution and laws of the United States. The Court of Appeals, having decided that the writ does not run to the detainees in any event, found it unnecessary to consider whether an adequate substitute had been provided. In the ordinary course, we would remand to the Court of Appeals to consider this question in the first instance. It is well settled, however, that the court's practice of declining to address issues left unresolved in earlier proceedings is not an inflexible rule. Departure from the rule is appropriate in exceptional circumstances. The gravity of the separation of powers issues raised by these cases and the fact that these detainees have been denied meaningful access to a judicial forum for a period of years render these cases exceptional. The parties before us have addressed the adequacy issue. While we would have found it informative to consider the reasoning of the Court of Appeals on this point, we must weigh that against the harms petitioners may endure from additional delay. And given there are few precedents addressing what features an adequate substitute for habeas corpus must contain, in all likelihood a remand simply would delay ultimate resolution of the issue by this court. We do have the benefit of the Court of Appeals' construction of key provisions of the DTA. When we granted certiorari in these cases, we noted it would be of material assistance to consult any decision in the parallel DTA review proceedings pending in the Court of Appeals, specifically any rulings in the matter of Bismullah versus Gates. Although the Court of Appeals has yet to complete a DTA review proceeding, the three-judge panel in Bismullah has issued an interim order giving guidance as to what evidence can be made part of the record on review and what access the detainees can have to counsel and to classified information. In that matter, the full court denied the government's motion for rehearing en banc. The order denying rehearing was accompanied by five separate statements from members of the court, which offer differing views as to scope of the judicial review Congress intended these detainees to have. Under the circumstances, we believe the costs of further delay substantially outweigh any benefits of remanding to the Court of Appeals to consider the issue it did not address in these cases. Section A. Our case law does not contain extensive discussion of standards defining suspension of the writ or circumstances under which suspension has occurred. This simply confirms the care Congress has taken throughout our nation's history to preserve the writ and its function. Indeed, most of the major legislative enactments pertaining to habeas corpus have enacted not to contract the writ's protection, but to expand it or to hasten resolution of prisoners' claims. There are exceptions, of course. Title I of the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, AEDPA, contains certain gatekeeping provisions that restrict a prisoner's ability to bring new and repetitive claims in second or successive habeas corpus actions. We upheld these provisions against the suspension clause challenge in Felker versus Turpin, 1996. The provisions at issue in Felker, however, did not constitute a substantial departure from common law habeas procedures. The provisions, for the most part, codified the longstanding abuse of the writ doctrine. AEDPA applies, moreover, to federal post-conviction review after criminal proceedings in state court have taken place. As of this point, cases discussing the implementation of that statute give little helpful instruction, save perhaps by contrast for the instant cases where no trial has been held. The two leading cases addressing habeas substitutes, Swain versus Presley, 1977, and United States versus Hayman, 1952, likewise provide little guidance here. The statutes at issue were attempts to streamline habeas corpus relief, not to cut it back. The statute discussed in Hayman was 28 U.S.C. Section 2255. It replaced traditional habeas corpus for federal prisoners, at least in the first instance, with a process that allowed the prisoner to file a motion with the sentencing court on the ground that his sentence was, inter alia, imposed in violation of the Constitution or laws of the United States. The purpose and effect of the statute was not to restrict access to the writ, but to make post-conviction proceedings more efficient. It directed claims not to the court that had territorial jurisdiction over the place of the petitioner's confinement, but to the sentencing court, a court already familiar with the facts of the case. As the Hayman Court explained, Section 2255 was passed at the instance of the Judicial Conference to meet practical difficulties that had arisen in administering the habeas corpus jurisdiction of the federal courts. Nowhere in the history of Section 2255 do we find any purpose to impinge upon prisoners' rights of collateral attack upon their convictions. On the contrary, the sole purpose was to minimize the difficulties encountered in habeas corpus hearings by affording the same rights in another and more convenient forum. See also Hill versus United States, 1962, noting that Section 2255 provides a remedy in the sentencing court that is exactly commensurate with the pre-existing federal habeas corpus remedy. The statute in Swain applied to prisoners in custody under sentence of the Superior Court of the District of Columbia. Before enactment of the District of Columbia Court Reform and Criminal Procedure Act of 1970, those prisoners could file habeas petitions in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. The act, which was patterned on Section 2255, substituted a new collateral process in the Superior Court for the pre-existing habeas corpus procedure in the District Court. But again, the purpose and effect of the statute was to expedite consideration of the prisoner's claims, not to delay or frustrate it. That the statutes in Hayman and Swain were designed to strengthen rather than dilute the writ's protections was evidenced, furthermore, from this significant fact. Neither statute eliminated traditional habeas corpus relief. In both cases, the statute at issue had a savings clause, providing that a writ of habeas corpus would be available if the alternative process proved inadequate or ineffective. The court placed explicit reliance upon these provisions in upholding the statutes against constitutional challenges. Unlike in Hayman and Swain, here we confront statutes, the DTA and the MCA, that were intended to circumvent habeas review. Congress's purpose is evident not only from the unequivocal language of MCA Section 7's jurisdiction-stripping language, no court, justice, or judge shall have jurisdiction to hear or consider an application for a writ of habeas corpus, but also from a comparison of the DTA to the statutes at issue in Hayman and Swain. When interpreting a statute, we examine related provisions in other parts of the U.S. Code. When Congress has intended to replace traditional habeas corpus with habeas-like substitutes, as was the case in Hayman and Swain, it has granted to the courts broad remedial powers to secure the historic office of the writ. In the Section 2255 context, for example, Congress has granted to the reviewing court power to determine the issues and make findings of fact and conclusions of law with respect to whether the judgment of conviction was rendered without jurisdiction or the sentence imposed was not authorized by law or otherwise open to collateral attack. The D.C. Court Reform Act, the statute upheld in Swain, contained a similar provision. In contrast, the DTA's jurisdictional grant is quite limited. The Court of Appeals has jurisdiction not to inquire into the legality of the detention generally, but only to assess whether the CSRT complied with the standards and procedures specified by the Secretary of Defense and whether those standards and procedures are lawful. If Congress had envisioned DTA review as coextensive with traditional habeas corpus, it would not have drafted the statute in this manner. Instead, it would have used language similar to what it used in the statutes at issue in Hayman and Swain. Where Congress includes particular language in one section of a statute but omits it in another section of the same act, it is generally presumed that Congress acts intentionally and purposely in the disparate inclusion or exclusion. Unlike in Hayman and Swain, moreover, there has been no effort to preserve habeas corpus review as an avenue of last resort. No saving clause exists in either the MCA or the DTA, and MCA Section 7 eliminates habeas corpus review for these petitioners. the differences between the DTA and the habeas statute that would govern in MCA Section 7's absence are likewise telling. In Section 2241, Congress confirmed the authority of any justice or circuit judge to issue the writ. That statute accommodates the necessity for fact-finding that will arise in some cases by allowing the appellate judge or justice to transfer the case to a district court of competent jurisdiction whose institutional capacity for fact-finding is superior to his or her own. By granting the Court of Appeals exclusive jurisdiction over petitioner's cases, Congress has foreclosed that option. This choice indicates Congress intended the Court of Appeals to have a more limited role in enemy combatant status determinations than a district court has in habeas corpus proceedings. The DTA should be interpreted to accord some latitude to the Court of Appeals to fashion procedures necessary to make its review function a meaningful one, but if congressional intent is to be respected, the procedures adopted cannot be as extensive or as protective of the rights of the detainees as they would be in a Section 2241 proceeding. Otherwise, there would have been no or very little purpose for enacting the DTA. To the extent any doubt remains about Congress's intent, the legislative history confirms what the plain text strongly suggests. In passing the DTA, Congress did not intend to create a process that differs from traditional habeas corpus process in name only. It intended to create a more limited procedure. It is against this background that we must interpret the DTA and assess its adequacy as a substitute for habeas corpus. The present cases thus test the limits of the suspension clause in ways that Hayman and Swain did not.